Chapter 16. A clear voice, like a chime of remote bells, a voice with no blood in it, spoke out of the air and sent a tingling through his frame. "They have already set foot on the sand and are beginning to ascend," it said. "The small one from Tholkandra is already here," said a second voice. "Look on him, beloved, and love him," said the first. "He is indeed but breathing dust, and a careless touch would unmake him. And in his best thoughts there are such things mingled as, if we thought them, our light would perish. But he is in the body of Maleldil, and his sins are forgiven. His very name in his own tongue is Elwin, the friend of the Eldila." "How great is your knowledge," said the second voice. "I have been down into the air of Tholkandra," said the first, "which the small ones call Telus. A thickened air is full of the darkened, as deep heaven is of the light ones. I have heard the prisoners there talking in their divided tongues, and Elwin has taught me how it is with them." From these words, Ransom knew the speaker was the Oyarsa of Malakandra, the great Archon of Mars. He did not, of course, recognize the voice, for there is no difference between one Eldil's voice and another's. It is by art, not nature, that they affect human eardrums, and their words owe nothing to lungs or lips. "If it is good, Oyarsa," said Ransom, "tell me who is this other?" "It is Oyarsa," said Oyarsa, "and here that is not my name. In my own sphere I am Oyarsa, here I am only Malakandra." "I am Perelandra," said the other voice. "I do not understand," said Ransom. "The woman told me there were no Eldila in this world." "They have not seen my face till today," said the second voice, "except as they see it in the water and the roof heaven, the islands, the caves, and the trees. I was not set to rule them, but while they were young I ruled all else. I rounded this ball when it first rose from Arbol. I spun the air about it and wove the roof. I built the fixed island and this, the holy mountain, as Maleldil taught me. The beasts that sing and the beasts that fly and all that swims on my breast and all that creeps and tunnels within me down to the center has been mine. And today all this is taken from me, blessed be he." "The small one will not understand you," said the Lord of Malakandra. "He will think that this is a grievous thing in your eyes." "He does not say this, Malakandra." "No. That is another strange thing about the children of Adam." There was a moment's silence, and then Malakandra addressed Ransom. "You will think of this best if you think of it in the likeness of certain things from your own world." "I think I understand," said Ransom. "For one of Maleldil's sayers has told us, it is like when the children of a great house come to their full age. Then those who administered all their riches, and whom perhaps they have never seen, come and put all in their hands and give up their keys." "You understand well," said Perelandra, "or like when the singing beast leaves the dumb dam who suckled him." "The singing beast?" said Ransom. "I would gladly hear more of this." "The beasts of that kind have no milk, and always what they bring forth is suckled by the she-beast of another kind. She is great and beautiful and dumb. Until the young singing beast is weaned, it is among her whelps and is subject to her. But when it is grown, it becomes the most delicate and glorious of all beasts and goes from her, and she wonders at its song." "Why has Maleldil made such a thing?" said Ransom. "That is to ask why Maleldil has made me," said Perelandra. "But now it is enough to say that from the habits of these two beasts much wisdom will come into the minds of my king and my queen and their children. But the hour is upon us, and this is enough."
"What hour?" asked Ransom.
"Today is the morning day," said one or other or both the voices. But there was something much more than sound about Ransom, and his heart began beating fast.
"The morning? Do you mean," he asked, "is all well? Has the queen found the king?"
"The world is born today," said Malakandra. "Today, for the first time, two creatures of the low worlds, two images of Maleldil that breathe and breed like the beasts, step up that step at which your parents fell and sit in the throne of what they were meant to be. It was never seen before. Because it did not happen in your world, a greater thing happened, but not this. Because the greater thing happened in Tholkandra, this and not the greater thing happens here."
"Elwin is falling to the ground," said the other voice.
"Be comforted," said Malakandra. "It is no doing of yours. You are not great, though you could have prevented a thing so great that deep heaven sees it with amazement.
Be comforted, small one, in your smallness. He lays no merit on you. Receive and be glad. Have no fear, lest your shoulders be bearing this world. Look, it is beneath your head and carries you.
Will they come here? Asked Ransom some time later.
They are already well up the mountain's side, said Perelandra, and our hour is upon us. Let us prepare our shapes. We are hard for them to see while we remain in ourselves.
It is very well said, answered Malacandra, but in what form shall we show ourselves to do them honour?
Let us appear to the small one here, said the other, for he is a man and can tell us what is pleasing to their senses.
I can see something even now, said Ransom.
Would you have the king strain his eyes to see those who come to do him honour? Said the Archon of Perelandra.
But look on this, and tell us how it deals with you.
The very faint light, the almost imperceptible alteration in the visual field, which betokens an Eldil, vanished suddenly. The rosy peaks and the calm pool vanished also. A tornado of sheer monstrosities seemed to be pouring over Ransom. Darting pillars filled with eyes, lightning pulsations of flame, talons and beaks and billowy masses of what suggested snow volleyed through cubes and heptagons into an infinite black void.
"Stop it! Stop it!" he yelled, and the scene cleared.
He gazed round, blinking, on the field of lilies, and presently gave the Eldila to understand that this kind of appearance was not suited to human sensations.
"Look then on this," said the voices again.
And he looked with some reluctance, and far off between the peaks on the other side of the little valley there came rolling wheels. There was nothing but that, concentric wheels moving with a rather sickening slowness one inside the other. There was nothing terrible about them if you could get used to their appalling size, but there was also nothing significant. He bade them to try yet a third time, and suddenly two human figures stood before him on the opposite side of the lake. They were taller than the Sorns, the giants whom he had met in Mars. They were perhaps 30 feet high. They were burning white like white-hot iron. The outline of their bodies, when he looked at it steadily against the red landscape, seemed to be faintly, swiftly undulating, as though the permanence of their shape, like that of waterfalls or flames, coexisted with a rushing movement of the matter it contained. For a fraction of an inch inward from this outline, the landscape was just visible through them. Beyond that, they were opaque. Whenever he looked straight at them, they appeared to be rushing towards him with enormous speed. Whenever his eyes took in their surroundings, he realized that they were stationary. This may have been due in part to the fact that their long and sparkling hair stood out straight behind them, as if in a great wind. But if there were a wind, it was not made of air, for no petal of the flowers was shaken. They were not standing quite vertically in relation to the floor of the valley. But to Ransom it appeared, as it had appeared to me on Earth when I saw one, that the Eldils were vertical. It was the valley, it was the whole world of Perelandra, which was aslant. He remembered the words of Oyarsa long ago in Mars, "I am not here in the same way that you are here." It was borne in upon him that the creatures were really moving, though not moving in relation to him. This planet, which inevitably seemed to him while he was in it an unmoving world, the world, in fact, was to them a thing moving through the heavens. In relation to their own celestial frame of reference, they were rushing forward to keep abreast of the mountain valley. Had they stood still, they would have flashed past him too quickly for him to see, doubly dropped behind by the planet's spin on its own axis and by its onward march around the sun. Their bodies, he said, were white, but a flush of diverse colours began at about the shoulders and streamed up the necks and flickered over face and head and stood out around the head like plumage or a halo. He told me he could, in a sense, remember these colours, that is, he would know them if he saw them again, but that he cannot by any effort call up a visual image of them nor give them any name. The very few people with whom he and I can discuss these matters all give the same explanation. We think that when creatures of the hypersomatic kind choose to appear to us, they are not, in fact, affecting our retina at all, but directly manipulating the relevant parts of our brain. If so, it is quite possible that they can produce there the sensations we should have if our eyes were capable of receiving those colours in the spectrum which are actually beyond their range. The plumage or halo of the one Eldil was extremely different from that of the other. The Oyarsa of Mars shone with cold and mourning colours, a little metallic, pure, hard and bracing. The Oyarsa of Venus glowed with a warm splendour, full of the suggestion of teeming vegetable life. The faces surprised him very much. Nothing less like the angel of popular art could well be imagined. The rich variety, the hint of undeveloped possibilities which make the interest of human faces, were entirely absent. One single changeless expression, so clear that it hurt and dazzled him, was stamped on each, and there was nothing else there at all. In that sense, their faces were as primitive, as unnatural, if you like, as those of archaic statues from Aegina. What this one thing was, he could not be certain. He concluded, in the end, that it was charity. But it was terrifyingly different from the expression of human charity, which we always see either blossoming out of or hastening to descend into natural affection. Here there was no affection at all, no least lingering memory of it, even at 10 million years' distance, no germ from which it could spring in any future, however remote. Pure, spiritual, intellectual love shot from their faces like barbed lightning. It was so unlike the love we experience that its expression could easily be mistaken for ferocity. Both the bodies were naked, and both were free from any sexual characteristics, either primary or secondary. That one would have expected. But whence came this curious difference between them? He found that he could point to no single feature wherein the difference resided, yet it was impossible to ignore. One could try, Ransom has tried 100 times, to put it into words. He has said that Malacandra was like rhythm and Perelandra like melody. He has said that Malacandra affected him like a quantitative, Perelandra like an accentual meter. He thinks that the first held in his hand something like a spear, but the hands of the other were open, with the palms towards him. But I don't know that any of these attempts has helped me much. At all events, what Ransom saw at that moment was the real meaning of gender. Everyone must sometimes have wondered why, in nearly all tongues, certain inanimate objects are masculine and others feminine. What is masculine about a mountain, or feminine about certain trees? Ransom has cured me of believing that this is a purely morphological phenomenon, depending on the form of the word. Still less is gender an imaginative extension of sex. Our ancestors did not make mountains masculine because they projected male characteristics into them. The real process is the reverse. Gender is a reality, and a more fundamental reality than sex. Sex is, in fact, merely the adaptation to organic life of a fundamental polarity which divides all created beings. Female sex is simply one of the things that have feminine gender. There are many others. And masculine and feminine meet us on planes of reality where male and female would be simply meaningless. Masculine is not attenuated male, nor feminine attenuated female. On the contrary, the male and female of organic creatures are rather faint and blurred reflections of masculine and feminine. Their reproductive functions, their differences in strength and size, partly exhibit, but partly also confuse and misrepresent the real polarity. All this Ransom saw, as it were, with his own eyes. The two white creatures were sexless. But he of Malacandra was masculine, not male. She of Perelandra was feminine, not female. Malacandra seemed to him to have the look of one standing armed at the ramparts of his own remote archaic world in ceaseless vigilance, his eyes ever roaming the earthward horizon whence his danger came long ago. A sailor's look, Ransom once said to me, you know, eyes that are impregnated with distance. But the eyes of Perelandra opened, as it were, inward, as if they were the curtained gateway to a world of waves and murmurings and wandering airs, of life that rocked in winds and splashed on mossy stones and descended as the dew and arose sunward in thin-spun delicacy of mist. On Mars the very forests are of stone. In Venus the lands swim. For now he thought of them no more as Malacandra and Perelandra. He called them by their Tellurian names. With deep wonder he thought to himself, my eyes have seen Mars and Venus. I have seen Ares and Aphrodite. He asked them how they were known to the old poets of Tellus. When and from whom had the children of Adam learned that Ares was a man of war and that Aphrodite rose from the sea foam? Earth has been besieged, an enemy occupied territory since before history began. The gods have had no commerce there. How then do we know of them?
It comes, they told him, a long way round and through many stages. There is an environment of minds as well as of space. The universe is one, a spider's web wherein each mind lives along every line, a vast whispering gallery where, save for the direct action of Maleldil, though no news travels unchanged, yet no secret can be rigorously kept. In the mind of the fallen Archon under whom our planet groans, the memory of deep heaven and the gods with whom he once consorted is still alive. Nay, in the very matter of our world, the traces of the celestial commonwealth are not quite lost. Memory passes through the womb and hovers in the air. The muse is a real thing. A faint breath, as Virgil says, reaches even the late generations. Our mythology is based on a solider reality than we dream, but it is also at an almost infinite distance from that base. And when they told him this, Ransom at last understood why mythology was what it was, gleams of celestial strength and beauty falling on a jungle of filth and imbecility. His cheeks burned on behalf of our race when he looked on the true Mars and Venus and remembered the follies that have been talked of them on Earth. Then a doubt struck him. "But do I see you as you really are?" he asked. "Only Maleldil sees any creature as it really is," said Mars. "How do you see one another?" asked Ransom. "There are no holding places in your mind for an answer to that." "Am I then seeing only an appearance? Is it not real at all?"
"You see only an appearance, small one. You have never seen more than an appearance of anything, not of Arbol, nor of a stone, nor of your own body. This appearance is as true as what you see of those."
"But there were those other appearances."
"No, there was only the failure of appearance."
"I don't understand," said Ransom. "Were all those other things, the wheels and the eyes, more real than this or less?"
"There is no meaning in your question," said Mars. "You can see a stone, if it is a fit distance from you, and if you and it are moving at speeds not too different. But if one throws the stone at your eye, what then is the appearance?"
"I should feel pain, and perhaps see splintered light," said Ransom. "But I don't know that I should call that an appearance of the stone."
"Yet it would be the true operation of the stone. And there is your question answered. We are now at the right distance from you."
"And were you nearer in what I first saw?"
"I do not mean that kind of distance."
"And then," said Ransom, still pondering, "there is what I had thought was your wonted appearance, the very faint light, O Yarsa, as I used to see it in your own world. What of that?"
"That is enough appearance for us to speak to you by. No more was needed between us. No more is needed now. It is to honour the king that we would now appear more. That light is the overflow or echo into the world of your senses, of vehicles made for appearance to one another and to the greater Eldila."
At this moment, Ransom suddenly noticed an increasing disturbance of sound behind his back, of uncoordinated sound, husky and pattering noises, which broke in on the mountain silence and the crystal voices of the gods with a delicious note of warm animality. He glanced round. Romping, prancing, fluttering, gliding, crawling, waddling, with every kind of movement, in every kind of shape and colour and size, a whole zoo of beasts and birds was pouring into a flowery valley through the passes between the peaks at his back. They came mostly in their pairs, male and female together, fawning upon one another, climbing over one another, diving under one another's bellies, perching upon one another's backs. Flaming plumage, gilded beaks, glossy flanks, liquid eyes, great red caverns of whinnying or of bleating mouths, and thickets of switching tails surrounded him on every side. "A regular Noah's Ark," thought Ransom, and then, with sudden seriousness, "but there will be no ark needed in this world." The song of four singing beasts rose in almost deafening triumph above the restless multitude. The great Eldil of Perelandra kept back the creatures to the hither side of the pool, leaving the opposite side of the valley empty, except for the coffin-like object. Ransom was not clear whether Venus spoke to the beasts, or even whether they were conscious of her presence. Her connection with them was perhaps of some subtler kind, quite different from the relations he had observed between them and the Green Lady. Both the Eldila were now on the same side of the pool with Ransom. He and they and all the beasts were facing in the same direction. The thing began to arrange itself.
First, on the very brink of the pool were the Eldila, standing. Between them and a little back was Ransom, still sitting among the lilies. Behind him the four singing beasts, sitting up on their haunches like fire dogs and proclaiming joy to all ears. Behind these again the other animals. The sense of ceremony deepened. The expectation became intense. In our foolish human fashion, he asked a question merely for the purpose of breaking it. How can they climb to here and go down again and yet be off this island before nightfall? Nobody answered him. He did not need an answer, for somehow he knew perfectly well that this island had never been forbidden them, and that one purpose in forbidding the other had been to lead them to this, their destined throne. Instead of answering, the god said, "Be still." Ransom's eyes had grown so used to the tinted softness of Perelandrian daylight, and specially since his journey in the dark guts of the mountain, that he had quite ceased to notice its difference from the daylight of our own world. It was, therefore, with a shock of double amazement that he now suddenly saw the peaks on the far side of the valley showing really dark against what seemed a terrestrial dawn. A moment later, sharp, well-defined shadows, long like the shadows at early morning, were streaming back from every beast and every unevenness of the ground, and each lily had its light and its dark side. Up and up came the light from the mountain slope. It filled the whole valley. The shadows disappeared again. All was in pure daylight that seemed to come from nowhere in particular. He knew ever afterwards what is meant by a light resting on or overshadowing a holy thing, but not emanating from it. For as the light reached its perfection and settled itself, as it were, like a lord upon his throne or like wine in a bowl, and filled the whole flowery cup of the mountain top, every cranny with its purity, the holy thing, paradise itself in its two persons, paradise walking hand in hand, its two bodies shining in the light like emeralds, yet not themselves too bright to look at, came in sight in the cleft between two peaks, and stood a moment with its male right hand lifted in regal and pontifical benediction, and then walked down and stood on the far side of the water. And the gods kneeled and bowed their huge bodies before the small forms of that young king and queen.